This is your community radio station, 88.3 Southern FM.
Coming up right now is the Space Show. Welcome to the Space Show, presented by members of the Space Association of Australia. Hello, I'm Andrew Rennie. On this week's The Space Show, 50 years ago tomorrow, the record-setting Skylab 4 mission returned to Earth. Skylab 2 astronaut Joe Kerwin is our guest as we note that anniversary. This is The Space Show with Andrew Rennie for the Space Association of Australia. These days, astronauts routinely spend 5 to 6 months aboard the International Space Station and the Tiangong Space Station. They barely get a mention in the newspaper or on television. Now, cast your mind back 50 years to 1973 and 1974. America's Skylab space station was big news. So much so that dozens of songs were written about it, particularly when it crashed into Western Australia in 1979. During 1973 and 1974, three crews occupied Skylab, each consisting of a trio of men. Those missions were called Skylab 2, 3 and 4. Here on the Space Show, we have been marking the 50th anniversary of each flight as they fell due. Essential to our narrative has been Skylab 2 Dr. Astronaut Joe Kerwin. Now, Joe is a great friend of the Space Association of Australia and, through it, of the Space Show. The late Peter Aylward spoke to Joe Kerwin several times. This evening, we mark the 50th anniversary tomorrow of the landing of the Skylab 4 crew after a record-setting 84-day flight. Now, Kerwin was not on that mission. Rather, he was with Pete Conrad and Paul Waits on the 28-day Skylab 2 mission. Skylab 1 was, of course, the space station itself. Now, Joe described to Peter Aylward and the membership of the Space Association of Australia how he became a member of NASA's group of scientist astronauts.
We started out with six, and one guy had to leave before we really got started. These are the first scientist astronauts. And we have an Air Force pilot, an engineer, a geologist, a researcher, and a physician. The other physician didn't make it all the way.
Some of the scientist astronauts had hopes of going to the moon. Indeed, geologist Jack Smith did so on Apollo 17 in 1972 December.
So, Joe, from a personal perspective, did you get an inkling that you might get a chance to go to the moon yourself, or was that kind of a different stream?
No. In fact, the very first pilots meeting after we were selected, I was sitting in the back of the room and Al Shepard was up front going through his Monday morning stuff. And he said, we're going to be picking up some new crews for the later Gemini missions here in the next couple of weeks. Just raise your hand if you want to go. I raised my hand. He said, put your hand down, Kerwin. There was never any doubt in my mind that I was not going to go to the moon. But that was okay, because the credentials I had just cried out for Skylab.
Yes, yeah.
We wanted to know how Joe Kerwin was selected for the crew of Skylab 2.
What stage were you selected to the Skylab 2 mission, Joe?
All this stuff went on before anybody was selected to
the crew.
But after Apollo 12, it was in 1971, Pete Conrad and Alan Bean volunteered to be commanders on two of the three Skylab missions. That was another big help to the program because we had their experience, and they were guys who actually wanted to do this long-duration flight, having just both landed on the moon. Everybody else who landed on the moon disappeared into the world of better jobs and stuff like that. But these guys stuck around and started running the program. And we had pretty much the same group of guys, but we didn't have any, we didn't have flight assignments yet. And Pete just did a Skylab sort of operational diagram and gave everybody their jobs for the next year and a half. And then it was about early 1972. We'd already run the Skylab Medical Experiments altitude test, where we got three poor astronauts to get in a chamber and building seven, was it, for 56 days and eat the food and do the exercise and do it all in this little place. Bill Thornton was one of the crew, and he's the guy who destroyed the exercise ergometer by running it at 300 watts when it was supposed to be topped at 250, and the wiring just burned out. So we said, well, what are you going to do to fix it? And the engineer said, we think we'll just cap it at 250 and not let you go any higher. And that was okay with us because we didn't normally go that high anyhow, just Bill. But that test was very important in fixing the food system and the exercise system and some of the other things that were difficult to design and were giving us trouble. And they fixed a lot of those problems. And then it was time for Deke and Al to issue at a Monday meeting a series of 15 names who would be now part of the Skylab astronaut crew, primes and backups. He didn't say who was who. He did not say which was which. He just gave us the numbers and smiled and walked out of the room. But it took a little time for us to figure out, or for Pete to tell us, that the first three names were the Skylab 2 prime, and then the second three were the Skylab 2 backup, and so on. The same backup crew sufficed for the second mission and the third mission. And so we had about a year and a half to exercise as crews, train as crews, do the formal simulations, do the final changes that we required or requested or begged for in the experiment protocols, all designed just to, our changes were all designed just to make us able to be sure we could do it. And about a month before launch, Chris Kraft called us up in his office. He said, are you guys ready to quit complaining and just get on with the program? And Pete assured him that the complaining was all over. We were with the program and we were going to make them proud. So we did.
Skylab 2 astronaut Joe Kerwin.
88.3 Southern FM.
Some people, even to this day, are confused about the nomenclature of the Skylab missions. Kerwin explains that this was because of the mission patches.
I'm not sure if I got anything else too exciting to say about the Skylab, although we did have a patch. And we got a science fiction artist to do the patch for us. And we liked it and made copies and all that stuff.
Now, I understand, Joe, that there's something wrong with the patch.
The bottom tips of those are the solar panels for the ATM, should be this side of the solar panels for the Skylab, but he made them behind.
Oh, no, there's something even more obvious than that. But
Well, Skylab 1, are you talking about that?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, that was, you know, it was funny. We thought, as we went through our training, even as, you know, for PJ and me and a couple other guys had been in this program on and off for 6 or 7 years, right from birth. And we didn't know that Huntsville wanted to do its own nomenclature. We figured there were three crews, so we'd name them 1, 2, and 3. And we actually got the patches done. And then Huntsville said, that's not correct. Our nomenclature is that the workshop itself is Skylab 1, and you guys are 2, 3, and 4. We insist on it. So we said, okay, but we're not changing the patch.
Fantastic.
And it was approved at JSC, and then they were already made.
And Kerwin took us through the genesis of Skylab.
It started out in 1965 with a sketch at a meeting in Huntsville. It went through the stage of, we don't have a Saturn V for Skylab, so we'll burn the engine to get you up in orbit, and then we'll let the oxygen out and the liquid, you know, and all the propellants backfill with an air mixture, and then you can start dragging in the parts to set up the station. It never got to the point of anybody actually saying that's stupid. We didn't even get that far. When the gods decided that Apollo 18, 19, and 20 would be canceled, and a Saturn V appeared, and immediately they started the plans for outfitting the inside of the fuel tank with everything you need in a hotel and workshop, and it was great details. But we had a triangular mesh floor and ceiling for the crew quarters, which is a reptilian remnant of when it was all going to be launched live, and the fuel had to get by the stuff on the way to the engine. We found that to be very useful. We adapted triangles on our shoes to fit in the spaces, and were able to stand and work wherever we wanted to, and we had our own bathroom. We had three bedrooms or crew quarters that were quite small but fit the bed. And if you wanted to put the bed in upside down, you could do that. It wouldn't matter to how you felt once your eyes were closed, and so on. You know, thinking of the team, the Huntsville team worked from 1966 until 73 when we launched. To get that all together, the hardware was so complex and untested, especially the habitability stuff, the food system, the waste management system, and some of the experiments, that we had to have a special test done a year before launch by three astronauts in an altitude chamber in one of the buildings at JSC. Called SMEET, the Skylab Medical Experiments Altitude Test. They put all the hardware they could in there. The crew stayed in for 56 days. They ate the food. They used the hardware. They found a lot of things wrong. And all of those things had a chance to be corrected and were corrected before launch. So that was a big deal.
During the development of Skylab, there was some strife between the two NASA centers, Huntsville, Alabama, and Houston, Texas.
There was quite a little friction between JSC and Huntsville. Huntsville having cleverly grabbed off their first and only manned mission as program managers. But they had done such a good job with laying out the program and using existing hardware as what turned out to be very adequate, more than adequate space station, that the two sides, you know, Chris Kraft and and Huntsville got along together fine in the end. And we went back and forth in our T-38s and did a lot of training in Huntsville, some training in Houston, it was all good.
The Skylab 4 mission of 84 days would not have been possible had the Skylab 2 crew not been able to repair the space station after a semi-disastrous launch.
All right, Joe, let's move on to getting close to your flight. This picture here, I think you can see, is the rollout of that Saturn V that you mentioned with the laboratory on top. What can you tell me about your recollections of that? Were you there at that rollout, or were you aware?
No,
of
No. We were training in Houston. We didn't spend a lot of time at the Cape. I don't remember how many days before launch we came down. It might have been 10 days or 7 days or something like that. But most of the training was in Houston. We saw them, the boosters already out there on the pad, and at the appointed day, we climbed into ours. We watched that one go off. It was a beautiful day and looked like a beautiful launch. And we had no inkling of the problem that was about to happen or that did happen.
Right.
We watched the launch from the roof of one of the buildings. And then we went back down to the crew quarters and picked up our headsets and immediately were plunged into the world of hurt.
Right.
The slow realization of that we lost our heat shield, that we're going to have a power problem. It looked to them as if they had voltage from one but not the other of the main solar panels. The temperatures inside the workshop were going up. It had arrived safely in orbit, and some of the deployments were good. The solar telescopes moved to their 90-degree off position, but we were in trouble. And almost immediately we...
Right. Yeah, I think I recall talking to you. You said that the original plan was that they would launch the Saturn V with the laboratory unmanned on one day, and you would fly the next day up.
The following day, the 15th.
Yeah.
We turned out we launched the 25th of May instead.
Right. So, of course, a lot of scrambling to actually find out if this actual... the laboratory was actually going to be usable for you to go up and occupy. So I think you indicated that I did identify a number of issues with the laboratory once it got up in orbit. I think the primary one was the heat shield that's supposed to protect the whole laboratory actually fell off on launch.
The two problems were the temperature in the habitable part of the workshop and the lack of electrical power. The only power we had came from the fact that the Apollo telescope mount, the solar physics experiments, had their own solar panels. So we had about 25% of the power we should have, but it was enough to keep a few lights on, to keep the life support system going, to do the medical experiments, because most of them took little or no power. And be up there and exist while the problems were being solved. And I'll get to that sequential fashion. But what we did was to go home, start working with the teams. We quickly went back to Huntsville because we wanted to get into the water tank and evaluate the ideas that were coming up quickly on how to cover the workshop with something to cool it off. There were two of them that required complicated EVAs, and we were in there working on one of them when we just got a call saying, Deke Slayton wants you guys to knock it off now. So we knocked it off and went back to the motel and explained to us that he was going to have the backup crew continue working on the parasols and solar temperature problems, but we were needed back in Houston to consult and be advised and rejoin the team for the other stuff. But meanwhile, you know, saving Skylab was really an engineer's triumph, and those 10 days were part of that, the big part of that triumph. how that whole team, Huntsville, Houston, the Cape, the contractors, and any company you called that thought that you thought could help would look in their shelves and say, we got this, we got that, and it would be delivered to the Cape the next day. There were airplanes going back and forth, and it was a guy sleeping under their desks, I should mention that. It was a heck of a thing. And one of the people that I'll shout out for was a guy named Jack Kinsler, who was a senior technician in the machine shop in Houston, and a very smart guy, very mechanically inclined. He walked into the mock-up and looked up at where the Sunnyside experiment airlock was located and said, you can open that up and access the space on the Sunnyside, right? Yeah, they said, they showed him how it worked. And he said, I've got an idea. He had his guys go to the stores and buy fishing poles, and he got a bunch of parachute cloth, and he gathered all this other stuff together. And in about 2 days, he had a device that would fit folded up into the tube that was designed to carry experiments to that airlock, and a way of pushing it out with poles thrust through a seal in the back end of it, so that it would come out all the way, get free of the surface, and then open, and you'd have a parasol, a shield of sorts against the sun. And it sounded too easy and too flimsy to be of any use, but he demonstrated right there in front of God and the center director and everybody, and it worked.
Wow.
So it's one of the ones, and of course it was the first one we used on orbit and lasted for our entire flight. There were two others that were packed up. There were the poles and the telephone company limlopper and ropes and all kinds of stuff that we might use. And then there was the backup crew, which was going to spend as much time as they needed, having seen the videos and the films and our discussions and descriptions of the problem, to try and figure out a way to go out and do a spacewalk in an area with no lighting, no handholds, no footholds, lots of sharp edges, and pull up that solar panel cover that was stuck down.
Right. So actually, I wanted to bring that up. So you identified relatively early on that obviously the insulation on part of the workshop had gone, but also one of the solar panels was ripped off, and the other one was not fully deployed, showing in the water tank in Houston or Huntsville, them trying to work out techniques to release that solar panel.
Right. Yes. Yeah. Okay. I'm looking at the picture now instead of looking at you. Seeing that's exactly right. That's probably a backup crew member. That's obviously a good rendition of the cover of the solar panel. It was about, 3 feet wide and 20 feet long. And right at the front of it there was the simulation of a little piece of aluminum that had, when the heat shield went, it had stuck around and wrapped itself and sort of welded itself onto that solar panel cover and was holding it down. It got up about six degrees and stopped.
Wow.
We had good pictures of that, and they had the pictures down there, and we're working on how you get down there. You're 25 feet away from every place. In fact, this is out of sequence, but on launch day, we did what I guess you could call was the spacewalk in the middle of day one. We rendezvoused 8 hours after launch. Pete went around carefully around the Skylab, observing, taking pictures. PJ was taking some video, which could be transmitted back to Earth, and figuring out what had gone wrong. And that, of course, was the main thing that he saw. So they were figuring out how we could get down there with a 25-foot aluminum pole and do the job.
No problem. So once they'd identified, guessed what was going on, because obviously before you guys got on orbit, there was no vision of the damage on the station. So they had to deduce, I suspect, from the instrumentation, the readings, what was going on. And this, I think this picture is some of the equipment that they tested and theorized it would be suitable to help you do your Skylab.
Some of the candidate equipment to go up there and do that job.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know if that's the actual telephone company, Limlopper. It looks a little different, but that was 50 years ago, and I'm not sure. It had jaws just about that big.
Right,
and it
right.
had long arms, and you pulled on rope A to close the jaws, and rope B would open the jaws. And
we'll have more of this conversation between Joe Kirwan, a Skylab 2 astronaut, and Peter Arwood on next week's The Space Show. This is a program which has been marking the 50th anniversary of the landing of Skylab 2, or the splashdown, I should say, of Skylab 2 on tomorrow, 50 years ago tomorrow. So we'll continue this story next week on The Space Show. You are, of course, tuned to Southern FM.